Coulson. He's the best cat with words around.
What the hell is this?
¿Dónde está la música?
Oh, Bat. Jorge, we thought you were away this week.
Yep. You didn't return your calls.
Look, gentlemen, I am a professional, and I received the check and the instructions in the mail, along with the lingerie catalog. Who are these three men?
In two words, a trio.
The cheapest talent money can buy.
We thought that since this week's guest is Coulson Whitehead, and he's written a little novel about the advertising agency.
Well, we recruited these three guys to back you up.
From the top, boys, Legato.
Coulson, he's the best cat with words around.
Well, that didn't work as well as planned.
No, no, no. Bat Segundo needs no choir.
Mucho stamina.
Just give me the mic and the bottle, and I'll take it from here.
Glug, glug. El whisky hace una mula.
Well, Bat, since we're a few minutes in.
I don't care. Maestro, start the music. Hello, kids. Bat Segundo here.
He's the best cat with words around.
This is ridiculous.
Running over time, boss.
Best we queue up the interview, I expect.
You'll be hearing from my attorneys, you blackguards, you scoundrels, you power lunchers who don't even have the decency to honor a professional talent.
Best we should indeed.
So I am here with Coulson Whitehead, author of The Intuitionist, John Henry Days, and now most recently Apex Hides the Herd. I'm very honored to talk with him. Coulson, how are you doing today?
All right. Good to see you.
Yeah, you were telling me earlier off the record as we sort of sat down that you actually had lived in San Francisco before. What was it? What's up with that?
I was here from 97 to mid-98, and I grew up in Manhattan, and something inside me said, well, I should try somewhere else to see if I can do it. I don't want to sort of wake up at 50 having only lived in New York.
Yeah.
So I came here and I just finished The Intuitionist and had to start working because I was pretty broke at that point. And I started working at CNET, a local computer company.
Familiar.
And it seems like they were just hiring people like off the boat because I was here and I had a job like in a week because they were trying to do like a Yahoo type web portal.
Yeah.
And so that's my start, and I worked there for a couple of months.
Now, was this where you wrote John Henry Days? I understand you wrote some of that on the clock or something.
I started doing web research on the clock.
Okay.
It was a pretty easy job. It was my job to do like a TV guide for web chats. So I'd write about pets.com, weekly web chat at 8, and make a listing of that stuff. So, I mean, it was pretty easy work. And I started researching John Henry, and during lunch hour, actually revising The Intuitionist. And so I paid back the debts I made from writing The Intuitionist. And I was like, well, I should maybe start freelancing again and working on the new thing. And then I quit CNET. And a week later, The Intuitionist was bought by Anchor. So it was like good timing. Like, I didn't know, but I felt it was time to.
You got in just before the bust there.
Yeah, yeah. So.
Okay, well, let's talk about Apex, which is the most recent novel. Now, Apex Hides the Hurt concerns itself with names, but I think I would argue, actually, that you've actually been concerned with names all along, whether it be sort of like the intuitionist versus the empiricists in your first book, or even Jay Sutter in John Henry Days. I was wondering, you know, what do names mean to you? Was Apex sort of kind of the natural culmination of perhaps what I have observed anyway is sort of an obsession with names throughout your work?
Well, I guess in terms of what you're saying, you know, both Lila May and Jay Sutter are, you know, trying to put their finger on things.
Yeah.
And in a way sort of naming their world and finding their place in it. When I started the book, I had an idea about corporate namers. I read an article in The Times about the naming of Prozac and how they try and find the right syllables that will make this sort of special resonance in the human brain and in pharmaceutical naming. And there's an article in Salon.com about identity firms. And so I knew I wanted to do something about that culture. I didn't know what. And I think from writing about the city, I was thinking about street names and how a famous guy like Sansom or Sutter can get their street named after them in San Francisco. And then 200 years later, we have no idea like who they are and about that process. So one day, I just put them together. And it started about branding and corporate names. But as usual, I start with like some sort of proposition. And then as I try to fill in characters and stories and try to find a way to make this idea come alive, more ideas about naming presented themselves, and corporate naming versus city names and personal naming.
Gotcha. Do you think contemporary fiction does a good job at sort of like dealing with nomenclature and what is behind a name? Because that's a major sort of thing throughout this. Some of the kind of prognostication on the part of your characters, as well as the, you know, some of the histories. Like, you know, for example, like, you know, Ted Judah, you know, who's Judah. He was this terribly exploited engineer, you know, and he, like, you know, he wanted to go ahead and build this track, and then he was engineered by the, he was exploited by the Big Four. So there's all these stories we don't know about, and you kind of, I think, touch upon that with, like, the notion of the City of Freedom, and I don't know, do you think that, you know, is this your answer to that kind of predicament, or...
You know, I don't set out to solve things, but then I guess questions arise as they work, and then I have to sort of follow through on them. But there are, you know, there are microhistories everywhere. Every corner, yeah, or every street has some sort of backstory. And I realized that in inventing the town of Winthrop and its history, I could address these different acts of, these different facets of naming, as I thought of different themes I wanted to talk about.
Gotcha. Now, the protagonist, of course, we should note, is not actually, doesn't have a name, unless, of course, his first name is he. I that could be a possibility.
Sure. He is nameless, and that was an early decision, and I wanted to put him in the same position as his products and the town. He's shapeless in a certain kind of way, formless and anonymous, and hopefully, you know, that the idea is that over the course of the book, he does sort of name his place in the world and himself as he is forced to consider the true implications of the branding job.
Now, I understand an early draft of this book you wrote before September 11th, and that you changed it and because you didn't like the protagonist. And I was wondering if the protagonist had a name at some point, or if, like, you know, not giving him a name was a kind of way to sort of tap into it, or whether it was a simple homage to, you know, Invisible Man, or...
Well, you know, there are a lot of nameless narrators.
Yeah.
So definitely I was taking off from there.
Yeah.
I've always enjoyed a good nameless narrator. So I started the book in the fall of 2000, and I wrote the first half. And then after 9/11, I had a few chapters of The Colossus of New York, and after writing straightforward journalism about the city after 9/11, I thought, well, in that cliched, oh, what does fiction mean now, which I'm sure you've heard about from interviews with other authors. I thought the fiction, I couldn't work on the book. Fiction seemed somehow false for a while. Mm-hmm. So I put it down to work on Colossus. And when I came back 2 years later and read the book after not looking at it for a long time, I realized that I couldn't relate to the character. Originally, he was conceived as a... he was still sort of riding high, and still, like, master of his game when he came to the town. And that just didn't work. He hadn't learned anything from the accident. So I had to retrofit the first half of the book so that he was not so much in control. He was sort of brought down by his misfortune. And he had to learn something about before and after. And he's in the after phase of his life after an accident. And that was more compelling to me after 9/11.
Well, the accident, we have this toe situation. I was wondering if this was kind of like he was nine toes in the grave of some sort of world, or...
Sure.
I don't know. I mean, I always try to figure out the metaphor of the toe here. Maybe you can elaborate on it. I mean, there are metaphors throughout all of your work, but this one seemed particularly very kind of, I guess, more literal than the norm from you. And I'm just wondering why you felt the need to sort of explore such a very explicit kind of metaphor, like, and give it such detail, too, you know?
Well, I think, you know, as I said, I started in 2000, so it was really coming off of John Henry days.
Yeah.
And that book had so many voices and took place in so many different time periods, and, you know, it was really sort of wild and sprawling. But I wanted to do something a lot more compact, and so the metaphors in the book they're open, but they're not as open as... Who is John Henry? What is the nature of elevation? So in pairing back what I wanted to do with this book, the toe, the accident, you know, I guess it fits in with different ways with what's going on in terms of and the bandage, with what's underneath and what do you put on top to hide it, whether it's a name or a Band-Aid. But I was trying to keep it on a smaller scale and keep it more controlled than I had before, just because John Henry Days was so big that it seemed to make sense at that point for me.
So you really kind of were struggling here to kind of find a sort of more kind of a voice of clarity with Apex, as opposed to like an ambitious, sprawling kind of narrative?
Well, more something more concise and something more, you know, I think at least there are more jokes in it, and I wanted to do something a little more comic without being constrained by, say, Lila May's sort of repressed nature and The Intuitionist, which I think produces a lot of deadpan humor about the nature of elevator inspection. Mm-hmm. There's the character of Chuck, the escalator inspector, who provides some comic relief, but I was really constrained by Intuitionist in terms of what I could do with the humor. So I wanted sort of more jokes and a more, definitely more linear kind of book.
Well, there's also one other aspect to your work in that it's sort of, it's this gray area between sort of the real and the surreal, in the sense that you find sort of, it's not like really out there magical realism, but it's just imaginative enough to sort of like tap into some strange concept or idea, like elevator inspectors warring against each other, or, you know, shifting perspectives in John Henry Days. But yet at the same time, your work is also very much about, I guess, this realist mode of really setting down some interesting details. For example, I mean, I will never forget the description of the buffet in John Henry Days. And yet, at the same time, in Apex, I didn't see a lot of that kind of detail. And I'm just trying to sort of figure out exactly why you avoided it or why you didn't dwell on it so much this time around as you did.
Well, I wanted a narrator who was really close to the protagonist, and that means a certain there's a certain kind of sentences I couldn't do, that kind of frenetic Jay Sutter sentence. Mm-hmm. That's how I see it. Didn't really work with him, I think, in his sort of character. So I thought, as the character was being shaped and he was evolving and doing certain things, he required a certain kind of voice. And so over time, that's sort of the way it came out. In terms of certain levels of abstraction, he is nameless. He's not physically described. So that's a certain kind of distancing technique, which I think does sort of bring it out of the gritty reality of the everyday. There's, I think, a small element of the fantastic in the way that he moves around the world, because he's not so... He's a little bit fuzzy.
Sure. Well, there's also... the one thing about Apex, too, is that there's a certain amount of absurdity to the namer's job, in that, you know, you kind of dwell a little bit... You don't exactly really pinpoint exactly how he comes up with the name, except through this kind of divinity of, like, all of these sort of, you know, language segments and units coming together. And also, you know, he goes to a museum. You kind of sort of obliquely suggest that, but you don't really sort of indicate exactly how he does it. And I was wondering if this was kind of a comment on work, which is a very sort of... You write about work, I think, more than a lot of other contemporary novelists.
But it's weird, because I've really had a few jobs.
Okay.
You know.
Okay.
There's a certain way you can't really dissect the creative process. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know when I've had a good day of work... I can say, oh, that's a new kind of sentence for me, or that's an image I didn't think I was working towards when I got up this morning. Mm-hmm. And you can't really say how that happens. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's something that happens over time, you know, more often, hopefully. Sometimes not as often as you'd like.
Sure.
But you can't really dissect it. And in terms of like, the name Apex Hides the Hurt, I mean, that I was trying to think of a key product for him, and I can't really say why I chose Apex or the slogan, how the slogan Hides the Hurt came about. I think it just came out of like ambient marketing, the sort of ambient marketing world that floats all around us from the minute we're born. So I can't pinpoint where this stuff comes from, and I think maybe that's what I was trying to get at with his sort of talent for naming. It's, I think if you're really good at something, whether it's whether it is writing, or you're a doctor, or anything you do, you can't necessarily take it apart and figure out how you do it. You just sort of, it fits your personality and your character and how you're formed. So I didn't want to go into it that much.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, it gives the narrator, that gives the protagonist a little bit of wiggle room in terms of a nameless territory to wander in. There's that aspect too, I suppose.
No, I think it works in different ways.
Yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, I wanted to comment upon the James Wood review of John Henry Days. He suggested that in that review that you had written a didactic novel that wants to be honored for not being so, and he compared it to Underworld. And I was wondering, in contemplating the idea of like a multicultural bandage, whether this, you know, I guess what I want to say is, to what extent do you as a writer fight the urge to preach? Because you're dealing with a lot of political themes, racial themes, and things like that. What steps do you take to kind of keep these under the surface? Is didacticism something that you fight on a daily basis when you write? Or?
No, I mean, most of what he says usually goes over my head, so I can't, you know, address, you know, Mr. Woods.
Yeah.
I feel like if you have something you want to say, cultures like this, then write an essay. Mm-hmm. If you're going to write a story, then you have to find characters and situations that are vehicles that can represent different aspects of themes or ideas you want to get across. But if it is didactic, and if the artist's mouthpiece is, then you haven't really done your job. Mm-hmm. I feel in terms of, I think definitely in John Henry Days, there are so many different interpretations of what that myth means that I feel there is no one sort of answer to the story that you can pin down. I'm definitely not trying to say John Henry means this or that.
Yeah.
I think there are 20 different definitions in the book, and you can pick one that applies to your life. So I think of all the books, that's definitely the one that has the most sort of mutable quality in terms of what is he trying to say. I'm actually trying to say, pick one. You know, they're all valid, and it depends on where you come from and your experience and how John Henry's going to work on your sort of personality and upbringing, which is why, you know, there is the blues singer in the 30s, there is the there's Jay Sutter in the present, there's the anonymous balladeer in the 1890s who's singing his version, because there is no one sort of interpretation. In terms of Apex, I think it's less open, and definitely the protagonist doesn't really come to 100% certain understanding of what it is to name, but I think he has come to some sort of accommodation with his job and what it actually means outside of the world of branding.
The one thing is, there's a common sort of theme of masculinity, I think, in your work. It's a very sort of prominent kind of underpinning. You've got, for example, like that boorish banquet in The Intuitionist, and you've got the whole, the sort of like the journalists all being kind of cocky in the hotel rooms of John Henry Days. And, you know, to some degree, a little bit of the sort of, you know, the protagonist's kind of, you know, attitude in Apex. And it almost seems that this, you know, masculine concentration is kind of like sort of like this underpinning to all of the themes that you're exploring. I was wondering if you could probably sort of indicate what provokes this, what sort of background you have that kind of, is this kind of something you can't sort of refrain, another kind of, you know, thing you just sort of shoot on the page? It's an effusive kind of thing, you know?
I feel like, you know, I mean, but if you bring in Intuitionist, it's not really there. I think it's more of a question of being. I think that both Alame and Jay Sutter are alike in that they are on sort of the cusp of a new sort of version of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the men's club of the Junketeers, I definitely was trying to go for a very kind of macho posturing, which is undercut by the fact that what they do is crap.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
So they talk a good game, but if you actually examine their lives, you know, they're pretty empty. With the protagonist of Apex, he's apart from the jockey white guy, as he calls his other colleagues. And when they're doing their sort of macho Robert Bly thing in the woods at the corporate retreat, he obviously doesn't relate to that. His sort of situation, I think, in terms of how he's defining himself in the world, is more about being and what am I doing here? I mean, I think that's what he feels when he's in the corporate scenes in the book. What am I doing in this boardroom with these guys and their constant back and forth for position? What am I doing at this retreat when I have this talent with these guys who have so many issues and I have no idea what they're talking about most of the time? So I think as someone who doesn't hang out with the sort of fratty crowd in in real life, you know, it was fun to sort of make up this, or for me, interpret this kind of essentially weak masculine identity. And I mean, and then I guess if you go back to John Henry days, you have John Henry, man of the earth, dynamic, physical character, against the sort of paper pushing freelancers. So I mean, so for me, a lot of their bravado is undercut by this actual dynamic character of John Henry.
Yeah, I actually wanted to ask you something. I'm actually responding to a 1999 Salon interview that you did with Lauren Miller. When you stated that when you worked at the Village Voice before this as a television critic, and you stated in that interview that you worked through various preoccupations with pop culture. But one could also argue, though, that with the sort of lengthy Altamont moment in John Henry, and also the screenplay like asides, which are quite interesting, too, in that book, and also the concentration upon the identity awards, the obsession with marketing and things like that, that you are still kind of focusing on pop culture in a sort of causistic sort of way.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, you know, we were talking about The Intuitionist, and what I was doing, and that was my second attempt at writing a novel. My first one was about a Gary Coleman type television star who I pick up 10 years later, and he's sort of abused by a Time Warner type entertainment combine. And a lot of it was about black imagery and pop culture. So when I was writing The Intuitionist, I was like, okay, no more. I've written about TV and all this, and music and books that deal with black identity and pop culture.
Yeah.
So there's no pop culture in The Intuitionist. And that's part of the features of the world, is that there's no, there's just really this, there's them and each other and their philosophies, and there's no sort of ambient media in the book. There's no television. There's one band, I think Rick Raymond, who plays at the banquet of the annual elevator inspector party. But I definitely had to say to myself, you've done this, lay off for a while. And then I think with John Henry days, it felt safe enough to talk about it in a different way than I had in criticism and in my first attempt at writing. So I found a different language to talk about the culture, and yeah, that sort of made it possible to return to it.
Well, I mean, is pop culture something that you kind of can't stop, you know, I mean, in the themes that you deal with, is it something that just is sort of ineluctable, or?
I'm definitely a big consumer of pop culture, always have been, and always watched a lot of TV. And when I started, like in college, when I was, I guess, trying to find my writerly identity, and read people like Nathaniel West, who was addressing this sort of new American pop culture of film, and the world of illusion we create and need and interact with in different ways in across the country, but also in California and Hollywood, I thought it was very liberating. I thought, oh, there's a way to talk about these things in a very interesting way. And the same thing with Thomas Pynchon or Ishmael Reed. These are guys who address contemporary culture and pop culture in a way that I found really instructive. So it's one of the things I like to talk about, and I think the job is to try to find different ways to address it if you are going to keep addressing it.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm kind of just sort of, you know, wondering, like, I'm kind of curious here in terms of, like, you know, why is pop culture just something that is just, I don't know. I mean, again, my question is sort of like whether it's inescapable, or whether it's something that, I don't know. I mean, does it come at the expense of sort of like, you know, fleshing out characters for you, or is this a struggle? I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe you can. I'm trying to sort of juxtapose it against, like, you know, the way that you build characters and the way you build narrative.
When I was starting to figure out how to write fiction in the 90s, I worked at the Village Voice, and in the book section, and we got all these books in every day, and I was aware of, like, a certain kind of Gen X book, which I hated, and definitely didn't want to do, and The Intuitionist is my way of saying I'm not writing about going to the 7-Eleven and mourning Kurt Cobain. What a horrible day it was. And at the same time, I was trying to rebel against what I thought it was a stereotypical novel of black Southern suffering. You know, so when I was figuring out how to write about different things, there were things I didn't want to do. So in terms of, I definitely feel the way I talk about pop culture isn't in this shallow way that yeah. I hated in certain people I read in the 90s. And if it is, and the characters aren't real enough to talk about, to convey certain aspects of culture and be real characters, then, well, you know, they don't work.
The other critic who actually took you on was Sven Berkitz, who he said also in John Henry Days, "We anticipate a full tilt grappling with myth, but instead Whitehead backs down, leaving us with the clatter and whir of failed connections, the reproachful silence of meanings left unexplored. The pages surge past with much skill and bursts of vigor, but they leave the exhaustive promise in their wake." So I think I'll put this issue to you. To what extent do you feel, you know, do connections should run under the surface, or does an author even have obligation to sort of put down those connections, or is it up to the reader? Is it up to the reader or the author?
If you don't do it, then does it work? If you don't, I mean, it's all a matter if it works or not. Yeah. And if you don't, you can explicitly make the connections or not, and it all comes down to whether it works or not. In terms of, I guess I haven't seen that review since it, you know, it's been 5 years, but yeah. It came out at the same time as the Grail Marcus review in book form.
Yeah,
and I can't remember which one it was, but one of them was like, "I love the contemporary stuff and hate the historical sections." Mm-hmm. And the other guy was like, "I love the historical sections and hate the present day stuff." Well, you know, I mean,
yeah,
two different, everyone has their, what they bring to the table. And if it doesn't work for you, you know, there are a lot of books out there that you can read. And like that, you don't have to read my take on how the contemporary society and American history intersect or don't intersect. I feel like different people get different things out of different books, and some people like the linearity of the intuitionist, some people like the intersection of the present day and the past in John Henry Days, and I think they may perhaps appeal to different sort of sensibilities, you know.
But if there's a design, a conscious design to your novels, does not the author have some sort of obligation to kind of at least, you know, provide clues or provide a few sort of, like, you know, arc lights, hey, go that way or something like that? I mean,
I think the structure provides those clues and how to read the book. And if it doesn't work for you, then it doesn't work for you. I mean, I can't write different books because other people think I have an obligation to do something else or write in a certain way. I mean, you have a website. I'm sure some people like the podcast more than the roundup. Some people like the roundup of what's going on in the literary world on the web more than when you write about San Francisco. And you're appealing to different people's sensibilities. I mean, you probably have an ideal reader who loves all three, and there's more to the reluctant than those things, but you probably have one ideal reader who likes all different parts of your output and your take on the world. But then some people like the podcast more, some people like the other stuff more, and do you have an obligation to conform to some ideal person? I mean, I think for everybody's expectations, I think you have to write the way you're going to write, and people are attracted to it or not attracted to it, but I think you're always beholden to what you're trying to say about the world and other people's definitions of what a great book is or what the perfect web blog is. Can't really come in because.
Okay, I hear what you're saying. I guess though, I mean, do you read? I mean, obviously you read your criticism, but do you find any value in it, or do you? What do you do to sort of evolve or develop as a writer?
It's the wrong time to eat a piece of cheese. I tend to read the first couple ones before a book comes out, and then you can see the general gist of it. I mean, definitely, I read. You know, once the first 30% of reviews come in, I just sort of skim them. Mm-hmm. And but the ones that come out before, because I am invested in how the book's going to do, I am curious. But then at a certain point, a good review is a good review and a bad review is a bad review. So in terms of how it goes as a writer, you keep writing and hopefully you find new things to talk about and different ways of talking about them. You learn from what you did last time, but then also set up obstacles in your new book so that you can learn anew and figure out how to do something else.
Okay. But I guess, though, I mean, you know, you were sort of suggesting earlier that Apex was sort of a way to kind of keep things sparse to some degree, or that it was a way for you to kind of, you know, not have the baggage of, like, some incredibly sort of ambitious, sprawling train of locomotives almost, you know, or, you know, train of cars. I guess, you know, I'm just trying to sort of get a sense of what you do to kind of, you know, keep out sort of like the sort of the bullshit people who are going to like love everything that you're going to love, or what you do to get the sort of like the criticism that, or you know, whether it's through peers or reviews or whatnot, to like kind of like, you know, personally evolve or develop. I mean, and you know, how you view your own work perhaps.
I'm probably like my own, as they say, well, actually, I can't be my own worst critic, because for people who dislike all my books, I'm sure, and have no desire to read them. But I tend to be really hard on what is finished, and I'm generally really far into something when a book comes out, so it's always an interruption to talk about what I did last year, because I am onto something new. I have a lot of great friends who give me feedback. Richard Nash, who's been on your site a few times. And, you know, I mean, I definitely, like, my mom was sort of lukewarm on Apex. Mm-hmm. And really liked Colossus. And I just did a reading at Stacy's Books here, and the woman, Ingrid, who works at the bookstore, was like, I like your fiction enough, but I really like Colossus a lot. And so I'm definitely starting to see with book four, they really have their own lives, you know, once you're done with them, and different people latch on different things and like different things about your books and dislike different things about your books. So in order to police myself, I just try to keep the books different. I mean, there are things I like to talk about: history, race, technology. But then the book I'm working on now is about growing up in the 80s and doesn't have like that kind of high concept armature of the first couple of novels, so that's interesting and new and presents a different kind of challenge. So I think trying to stretch yourself is, I think, the best form of self-policing.
Yeah. And when you had mentioned this to me before, I was kind of remarking that it's reminiscent of Black Swan Green, which you have not yet read. So that's I would almost suggest to you that, you know, write this book and then read Black Swan Green, maybe almost.
Well, I mean, I was reading The Fortress of Solitude and seeing how Jonathan Lethem wrote about New York in the late 70s, early 80s, that made me think, oh, well, I've really resisted the stereotypical coming-of-age novel, but I really like what he did in terms of talking about New York at that time. And as someone from my generation who's writing about something I know very concretely, and it was very liberating to see someone I knew and whose work I really like taken on, and to me, sort of legitimized writing about the 80s. Mm-hmm. And I think that goes back again to the Gen X novel, and how much I hated it. The cliches I really don't want to address and try to avoid, and one of them is like the slacker novel, the coming-of-age novel. And then I think if I do want to tackle those forms, I have to figure out a way that's interesting, new and interesting, to write about being 15 in 1985. That's new, and I think Lethem, I really enjoyed what Lethem did, and I have my perspective on what it meant to be 15 and 85, and so that's what sort of I bring to the table. Mm-hmm. So hopefully it'll work out.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, though, you know, you personally change as a person. Your view changes in the sense that you start to see connections in your own life, or, you know, or in other people's lives, so that you know, oh, wow, I didn't realize that, and therefore you bring something brand new by way of I mean, your perspective is, I would say, very, very fresh throughout all of your work. And I don't know, even if you were to describe, you know, something quotidian, it would probably almost, you know, be unique, I guess, because you are very much into, like, for example, describing a journalist as a sort of entomological entity. So, you know, I mean, which not everyone does, you know.
Well, I think, you know, this also goes back to what you're saying about how do you improve as a writer, and that, and I've never been able to pull off a first-person voice in a book. Huh. And, I mean, for short periods, for a monologue or something like that, or when I'm very close to somebody for a short period of time in a book. But can I do a first-person voice? Will my book on the 80s be a first-person voice? I'm not sure if I can pull it off yet. So I think, I mean, perhaps now I'm old enough that I can do it without having too much of my personality come in or reverting to some sort of cynical and more detached point of view than would work in a first-person narrator. So, I mean, hopefully it'll work out, is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And I haven't done before, so I'm not sure if it will.
But the Altamont chapter in John Henry is very much that 14-page or whatever first-person voice going on there. So, I mean, you know, what was it about Altamont that sort of made you channel that? I mean, I was when I first read that, I like said to myself, man, he really, really, you know, he really is very passionate about this particular subject. You know, I mean, I almost got the sense that you wrote that in one long sort of, you know, cluster. At least that's what it felt like.
Well, he's a fun character to do.
Yeah.
And in there, I can touch on different themes about Black sacrifice, the guy who was killed.
Yeah.
For me, a lot of the purpose in originally doing it was making an endpoint of communal pop culture. We start off with singing John Henry songs, and it's very intimate. It's oral culture. A few people in a room or on a chain gang. And then we've gone to like the nightmare of a shared pop culture, which is Altamont. 200,000 people and people dying. So his monologue could illustrate different themes and set up a point in the book where it really opens up. So it sort of prepares you for that. But it is 14 pages.
Yeah.
Would you want to hang out with Dave Brown for a whole novel? Yeah. I don't think so. So I think that's the real sort of problem for me anyway with a first-person voice is sustaining it for 300 pages in a compelling way.
Well, I mean, I'm curious, though. I mean, why did you jump around so much in John Henry days? I didn't quite get an answer to that question. I mean, you know, the compulsive theory that was put forth by reviewers. And do you find yourself to be a compulsive writer, or what? Why the need to sort of jump around so much? I mean, maybe you could.
Well, you know, again, going back to the next book being an antidote to the previous book. The Intuitionist was so linear, had a really strong plot, and I thought, oh, I can do that. So I wanted to explore a more thematic plot, and as I did more research into John Henry, well, for one thing, I knew I wanted to have more voices, definitely, instead of like this sort of really controlled, repressed narrative voice that follows La Lamé around. There was that, and then also, the more research about John Henry I read, the more I did realize that there are these different permutations to the myth. He means something to Paul Robeson, to a blues singer, to someone who's trying to become famous by getting their ballad on sheet music, and something to Jay Sutter and the people in the town. And I really wanted to have them in. So it started with, and also having John Henry in. So it started, I think, with deciding to put John Henry in and try to think of what the impact of knowing your fate would have on your life, and trying to have him, try to explore him as a man and not this mythological figure. Is he scared? Is he eager to test himself? And once I decided to put him in, and was starting to describe these different sort of fractal views of John Henry, I realized I wanted to have these different voices in and different points of view. So that was the origin of the structure.
Now, does the theme or the character or the allegory, what comes first when you devise one of these narratives? I mean, how many drafts do you generally go through because of all the sort of levels and layers of material in all your work?
I start with, I start with an idea. How do I update the industrial age myth of John Henry for the information age? And there are no characters there. There's no story. Mm-hmm. So do some research. And then each time you figure something out, like, okay, it'll take place in Hinton and Talcott. Well, what the history of those places? Who lives there? What does the protagonist do before? And each time you figure out something, there's a new problem presents itself. So I organize material for like 6 to 9 months and just try to get an outline, and the outline changes. It gets smaller or bigger depending what happens. But I generally know the beginning and the end, and the middle can be fuzzy as I figure it out. But and themes emerge, I guess. When I started thinking about elevators, I didn't think about elevation. And when I chose elevators, I know that it's obvious, but we couldn't build higher than 5 stories if we didn't have a safety elevator. So they enabled the modern city, and so it became more about... Sorry.
Oh, no.
It started to be... The idea of how cities evolve started to come in. So research gives me ideas of how to proceed, and then the language I'm going to use for it starts to appear as I write scenes or figure out characters, and so over time it evolves.
Research is more of your kind of muse, but at the same time, this new work, it sounds like it's, since you're drawing more from personal experience, it's not so much research. Or what's the level of research?
You mean with Apex?
Apex is a totally... I mean, I see that there's definite research in that, and you definitely were inspired by the Times article, but even like this new work that you just started, where it's like, it seems more personal experience than research.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's personal archaeology, so if you're... I guess the pitfall of something that comes directly from your personal experience is that you think it's interesting, but is it interesting to other people? So shaping it into art as opposed to just memoir there's art in memoir, but just a direct transmission of your experience. The problem is, well, is that a story? And if it's not a story, how do I make it a story? And what's compelling about it? What's compelling about what I know about my upbringing that other people want to read about or care about?
Why should you've got a MacArthur Fellowship. Why should you even care about, like, what people think about your own sort of personal experience? Or is it a matter of shaping it into a narrative?
Well, I mean, it's not about how it'll be received, but does it work? Hmm. I mean, is it just like... And then I played in television and had a good time with my friends. When is it actually art? I mean, so it's not about expectation. It's about, does it work as a story to my satisfaction?
What would not work from, hypothetically, if you were to pull an experience from life, I just want to get a sense, since you have such an unusual perspective, I think, what is just not, topics that you're going to write about?
Well, it's more of the question, are you being self-indulgent? Mm. I mean, do people really want to know what I thought about Thor number 237? How... Can I write about comic books in an interesting way for other people that work in a story? I can talk about comics all day. I can talk about cable offerings on major cable systems in the early 80s, until the cows come home. Is that a story? Not in itself. How do you make it a story? How does it say something about the character or the world? And that's the problem.
So really, it seems to me like a matter of like having these vast depositories of culture and research and information and commingling them in a way that sort of meets a sort of a human narrative of some kind. Is this kind of the way the sort of the Coulson processing unit works? Or?
Well, yeah, I mean, going back to starting out with a proposition, like, what if a corporate namer had to name a town? That's not a story. It's an idea.
Yeah.
And then how do you make that into... How do you translate into that into something that's written that is... conforms to my idea of what a story is and what it has to do.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, I know you have to get going, and there is one thing I have to ask you. Is there any way we can broker a detente between you and Richard Ford? Or?
I doubt it.
What?
Is it broker a talk?
Broker a detente or a talk, or you know.
Well, I think I think he's a douchebag, and I have no desire to have a detente with him. I guess if I knew he had still a little faith in his work, that a bad review would, you know, wreak such psychic terror on him, I would have given him the respectful review that he deserves in his mind, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Coulson, thanks very much.
Sure.